From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present the second half of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank talked with Middle East and Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and his guest.
You talk about some false impressions that are being created, and I don't think you and I have ever talked about this, but let me run this by you. I hear, whether it's Fox News or it's MSNBC or whatever it is, I always hear this moniker, radical Islam. At least now, more and more people are using the moniker, but it seems to me that what you're saying, Raymond, is that all of this is not radical Islam. It sounds more like run-of-the-mill Islam.
Yeah, it's mainstream Islam. You know, the adjective radical has been placed there to imply there's something weird or strange about it. And so, you know, we're given the dichotomy of moderate Muslim or just Muslim, which implies moderate, and then radical Islamist. Okay, I don't mind making the distinction between Muslims because, yes, there's, as we already mentioned, there's a lot of Muslims who are just Muslims because they live in Muslim countries and they just want to make do. It's not even that they believe in the Quran or anything, okay? And those do tend to be moderate, okay? But for me, a true Muslim, if you look at that word, Muslim in Arabic, means it's connected to Islam. Islam in Arabic and Muslim, they're conjugates of one word. And Islam means submit. Muslim means one who has submitted, okay? So what is it they're submitting to? They're submitting to what's known as Sharia. Basically, all these laws that have been promulgated supposedly by Allah or more realistically by Muhammad and, you know, by the schools of law and so forth. So if you get a Muslim, so-called, who, let's say he drinks and doesn't fast and, you know, he's a cool guy that lives next door and you hang out with him and he goes to parties, well, he's not a Muslim because he's not following the laws of Allah, right? And he hangs out with Christians and Jews, and he kind of likes them. Well, that's the Muslim we talk about. We say he's a great guy. But in fact, he doesn't even warrant to be called a Muslim because he is actually defying Allah's laws, including do not befriend the Christians and Jews, which is verbatim in the Quran. So for me, the radical, I would call the so-called radical Muslim a Muslim, and I would call what we call a moderate Muslim, I would call them cultural or nominal Muslims. People are just born into it. You know, they celebrate Ramadan. They don't even go to mosque. They don't pray or what, you know, do five prayers and so forth. So, yeah, there's that distinction. But the radical one, or the ones that we call radical, are the real ones. They are the ones who have submitted to Allah. And, in fact, the word radical, the English word radical, implies going to the root and the essence of something. And it's not a bad thing if you're radical. It actually, I mean, that's the connotation, I think, in English, that it's bad. But it only means something being very true and being very pure to its essence. And so to me, okay, the radicals are the real Muslims. They're living it. They're doing it. And again, from a historical point of view, of course there was no radical moderate distinction. That was just created now to try to, you know, make sense of all this and say, no, there's good Muslims and bad Muslims, and most of them are good. Historically, all the stuff, you know, think of the horrors that ISIS has done. All of that is mainstream and standard. Never once was it portrayed by either medieval Muslims or medieval Christians as some sort of aberration in Islam. That's just what Islam does.
Kind of sounds like when Obama called ISIL or ISIS the JV team. In some sense, historically, that is true because there were a lot darker permutations of Islamic jihad throughout 14 centuries of history.
Exactly. And see, that's, again, the point of the book. You know, people who know history, okay, and this is what I'm trying to correct, they'll hear about, okay, the Ottomans, and then they'll hear about the Moors in Spain, and they'll hear about the Tatars and, you know, Tatar yoke or Mongol yoke of Russia. And all of these seem like disparate, you know, historical episodes that don't have anything to do with one another. And certainly they don't have anything to do with Islam. Come on, Ottomans, they're just like any European power. They were just fighting for power and glory. Maybe they threw a couple of Islamic words out. It was just in token. And, you know, and this is how essentially history has been taught. So that's one of the reasons I'm trying to put it as one general story. In fact, the underlying theme of the Moors in Spain, the Arabs and their invasion of North Africa, the Turkish invasion into the Balkans and the siege of Constantinople, the Tatar yoke of Russia and all that. You look at the sources, you're going to find it's all about Islam. They all do the same things that ISIS does. They all scream Allahu Akbar. They all talk about how they're going to go to heaven and copulate with the Huris, these wonderful, beautiful, supernatural women. All of them, all of these episodes are in there. They all talk about how they have to kill and destroy Christians because they're infidels. They have to break the cross. And in fact, they do break the cross and they do burn churches. All of this in every chapter of this book is manifest. And it shows you that it's one long continuum and that it transcended, you know, designations such as the Moors or the Arabs or the Ottomans or the Tartars or the Mongols, and that it was, in fact, one long jihad. And but unfortunately, historians have just broken it up and turned it into little disparate anecdotes that are in no way, shape, or form connected to each other, when in fact it is all one long, big lump story. And that's what I hope the book will show and make clear to people.
You know what's interesting, though? I mean, if you, as Raymond Ibrahim, go to a university today and try to talk about this, there'll be a lot of people that will not engage in the free exchange of ideas. They'll probably boo you off the stage before you have an opportunity to open your mouth, and the vast majority of those booing will never have read your book to begin with.
Well, you know what? You are correct, but I'll tell you that there's a lot of dissembling going on, because what you're saying has actually happened to me. But I'll give you an example. I spoke in Seattle some years back. I was invited at a college, and it was packed. There were people sitting on the floor. I mean, it was well advertised. It was packed, and, you know, but there was a woman in a burqa, or actually a niqab, or burqa, whatever you want to call it, basically long black thing covering her, sitting all the way in the back. And I got a standing ovation from everyone. She had, you know, a question, as other people did, which was, you know, oh, but don't you, you know, that I'm an Islamophobe, essentially, okay? But I felt, and so did others, it was just a 100% successful event and well-received. Now, it came out in the media, and when it came out in the media and on the news, the only person they had speaking was that woman. They didn't show you all the people. They showed you, it wasn't just her, there was another Muslim man who also made some comments. They only showed those two people. They didn't show you how big the crowd was. And so my point is, you're right that for sure the system is going to portray it and make you and everyone think and feel that our message is going to be booed from the start, when in fact there's so many people who are receptive to it, but the media and the powers that be, they just suppress these people. They don't let you know they exist, and they only highlight the bad ones. And they're certainly there, and they do certainly criticize. And all you said is true, and they won't even read the book, and they'll condemn me from the start. I get all that too as well. So I'm not trying to say that that doesn't exist. I'm also saying that the good news is there's a lot who do get it, except you wouldn't know it if you follow the news, because they're just completely blotted out of the picture.
And you know what I think, Raymond? I think what's happening now is things are shifting. In other words, even 6 months ago, your narrative, my narrative, would have been a narrative that is discounted, thought to be Islamophobic, thought to be out of touch with reality, all these kinds of things. But as people are seeing the effects of migration without assimilation, particularly in the EU countries, as they're seeing more and more terrorist attacks, the narrative seems to be at least gradually shifting towards what you are communicating.
And absolutely. You know, I call that, I wrote an article years back, I call it Islam's rule of numbers, which is basically, you know, it was one thing 10, 20, 30 years ago when your average American was like, Islam, huh? Muhammad, who? They didn't know anything about it. They didn't feel anything from it. They weren't impacted by it. It was just at most some religion over there across the sea. But in as much as Muslims migrate into the West, into Europe and so forth, and their numbers grow, so are we going to see a purely Islamic phenomena that is part and parcel of the Islamic world. And so now that Muslims are in large numbers in Europe, you're seeing what happens in the Middle East, Christians. You're seeing women being abducted and raped. You're seeing churches. You'd be surprised in how much the media tries to dissemble this. But churches in Germany and France are being attacked, and crosses being broken, and statues of Jesus and Mary being beheaded, and all this sort of thing is happening in London, which is it has a Muslim mayor, because it's so heavy Muslim population, you get people beheaded in the streets with a meat cleaver, screams of Allah Akbar. Well, that's not uncommon in the Islamic world. But now it's coming to the West because the numbers of Muslims are growing. And so obviously the same phenomena that belongs to them there is going to grow with them here. And I'm sorry to say, but if this is what people need to wake up, then so be it. You know, if people cannot understand it theoretically and through history or doctrine, and if they must see it up close and personal, then, you know, let it happen if that's the only way for them to get it. And I think that's where we're at now. And the other thing real quick is the phenomena of ISIS. It's what ISIS has done is they're the ones who broadcast their stuff. If it was left to the mainstream media and ISIS was intentionally hiding their atrocities, we wouldn't know about it. But because ISIS likes to boast of what it's doing, they're the ones that have made this very popular. And so the mainstream media has to go along with it and just come do damage control. And so, no, this isn't Islam. But the fact is, before ISIS, Muslim organizations, including Al-Qaeda, were doing the same exact atrocities, but they didn't publicize it, and neither did the mainstream media. And so that's why all of this is like a big wake-up call to the West, and either it responds or it doesn't.
I want to turn a corner here in a minute, but you just keep stimulating with me with all these different thoughts. I mean, we think, for example, that Iran is the axis of evil along with North Korea. Talk about Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is almost cast as though it is our best friend. And I don't know who did this. I think it was Friedman in an editorial talked about how the reason that we don't expose Saudi Arabia is because, well, those who take drugs are not going to expose their pushers. And in a sense, that's kind of what's going on. Here we have Wahhabism being exported throughout the world, hundreds of millions of petrodollars being used to do that. And it seems to me that this is at least as big a threat as ISIS.
Oh, I mean, to me, I've written articles where I call Saudi Arabia the head of the Islamic snake, the head of the jihad. Without Saudi Arabia and its funding, we would not have ISIS. Okay, so for starters, like you pointed out, Saudi Arabia, through its petrol money, spends $100 million annually disseminating what we call Wahhabi or Salafi ideologies and creating those types of mosques and spreading that kind of books and literature by the Salafi mentality, which is the ISIS mentality. There's nothing that ISIS says or believes that Saudi Arabia doesn't practice. You know, Saudi Arabia won't allow a single church on its ground. Saudi Arabia executes the apostate and whips them. Saudi Arabia will attack and punish the blasphemer. If you're a Christian visiting Saudi Arabia as a worker and they catch you celebrating quietly Christmas in your own apartment, you will be arrested. Okay, so this is ISIS to me. And this is why I find very hypocritical when I see a politician, including Donald Trump, come and talk about how horrible ISIS is and then go dance waving swords with Saudis. Well, that's the same group. And Saudi Arabia is the one that funds and gives the most material support to groups like ISIS. And so this is why you can see we're in our predicament, because on the one hand, we can lambast ISIS and say they're the bad guys. On the other hand, we go and sleep in the same bed with their supporters and the ones who formulated their ideology. But absolutely, I think Saudi Arabia far transcends Iran as when it comes to the question of Islam as a complete threat, because they're the ones without their money. You know, this rise of Islamic terrorism is concomitant with the use of petrodollars in the 70s in Saudi Arabia and its rise on the market. It's the same story. And so until we acknowledge that and actually do something about it, well, it's just pointless talking about ISIS and this and that, because we are already, our presidents bow to, hug and kiss and dance with basically the creators of ISIS.
You know, I wrote a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. In that book, I start out with the story of being in Iran during the 33rd anniversary of the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. And I'd never been in a Muslim theocracy before, and so I'm a little timid. First of all, I have to hold the airline harmless. I have to sign a waiver for United Emirates or they're not going to fly me over there. I get on the plane, I sit down next to this unbelievably sophisticated Muslim woman. We get in a conversation. She says, you have any problems in Iran? Let me know. You know, I'll help you. I deplane in Tehran and two Muslim men kiss me on either side of the cheek and they say salam. Then I end up going to my apartment downtown Tehran and I don't dare come out of my room because I'm intimidated by the environment. So the next morning, my translator, Fatima, she asked me, you know, how was your evening? I said, well, I kind of stayed in my room. She said, why? I said, well, I was intimidated. She said, you can walk the streets of Tehran in the middle of the night. No one's going to harm you. And I did that for 5 nights.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim. Grave is the specter of global Islamic jihadism, now exacting mass genocide on Christians in the East and ever-multiplying terrorist attacks throughout the West. Worse still, Western governments, academic institutions, and media outlets seem bent on exporting a false narrative, respecting the religious animus animating global Islamic jihadism. In Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, Hank Hanegraaff not only outlines the problems in accessible and memorable fashion, but moves toward potential solutions in the clash of civilizations. Receive your copy of Muslim as our appreciation for your financial partnership. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's many outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. But don't go anywhere. We're coming right back with more of this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Take the Bible Answer Man broadcast wherever you go on your phone or handheld device with the Equip app, free from the Christian Research Institute. The Equip app is available for both Apple and Android devices, so you can listen to the Bible Answer Man broadcast live each day or listen to archived programs at your convenience. You can also subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, make a donation to CRI, and read well-researched, trustworthy articles that will help you defend the faith and grow in your walk with Christ. With the Equip app from the Christian Research Institute, you'll have the answers you need to questions about Christianity, cults, and issues of theological and apologetic concern right at your fingertips wherever you go. So go to equip.org/app and download the Equip app for your phone or tablet today. Again, that's equip.org/app. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Recent scholarly research has been significantly more open toward Jesus' healing the sick, his empty tomb, and even his post-resurrection appearances. So why have these same critics not fallen to their knees and proclaimed, "My Lord and my God"? Other topics include the Jewish Talmud and its use for Christian apologetics, the Cohen brothers and the riddle of existence, defending the biblical view of human sexuality using an effective Socratic question approach, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. That's equip.org. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon?
And what is the real meaning of 666? Order The Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. On this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, we're bringing to you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast, in which Hank talked with Middle East and Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim. Let's rejoin their conversation.
You know, I wrote a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. In that book, I start out with the story of being in Iran during the 33rd anniversary of the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. And I'd never been in a Muslim theocracy before, and so I'm a little timid. First of all, I have to hold the airline harmless. I have to sign a waiver for United Emirates, or they're not going to fly me over there. But I'm, you know, in line and, you know, with the Muslims, and I see burqas, and it's a very uncomfortable situation for me because I'm out of my element. I get on the plane, I sit down next to this unbelievably sophisticated Muslim woman. We get in a conversation. She says, "You have any problems in Iran? Let me know. You know, I'll help you." I deplane in Tehran, and two Muslim men kiss me on either side of the cheek, and they say salam. Then I end up going to my apartment downtown Tehran, and I don't dare come out of my room because I, you know, again, I'm intimidated by the environment. So the next morning, my translator, Fatima, she asked me, you know, how was your evening? I said, well, I kind of stayed in my room. She said, why? I said, well, I was intimidated. She said, you can walk the streets of Tehran in the middle of the night. No one's going to harm you. And I did that for 5 nights because of the jet lag and the time change and so forth. So I'm really throwing all this out, Raymond, because, you know, it's so hard for me sometimes to explain the difference between people and a religion that ensnares. I honestly, and I can tell you this, with no contradiction in my own mind, I don't remember a single person treating me badly in Iran. I mean, if I was trying to make change, I mean, obviously could use a credit card, but, you know, I'm asking people to make change for me, and people are making the change for me, wanting pictures with me. So I got treated by nothing but acts of kindness. So it seems to me when you paint that picture on the one hand, it's really hard sometimes to communicate, these are people, and many of these people are wonderful people, hospitable people, very, very different from the religion itself that ensnares them.
You know, I'm very glad, Hank, you bring this up, because I'm in 100% agreement with you. And that's what bothers me, is the sort of lumping all. You know, I'm a vocal opponent of Islam, the ideology and the doctrine, but I understand, you know, if you're born Muslim, doesn't mean you're foaming at the mouth and screaming jihad. And unfortunately, some people, you know, it's either they're all wonderful and Islam's great, or if you're a Muslim, you're just out to destroy and kill. Obviously, there are so many shades. A lot of Muslims, you know, after long struggles and spiritual struggles, convert, for example, from Islam to Christianity. Well, those Muslims, usually in the years before they converted, were, you know, very good people. They didn't do jihad, but they were Muslims. They were called Muslims. So there's definitely a vast continuum of different groups of individuals who are Muslims, and it you cannot say if you're a Muslim, you're all of a sudden a bad person. On the other hand, I would say, and I would caution, that Islam is a violent ideology. And so if a person is Muslim, well, I mean, I would approach it with some care and some caution. I would still give them possibly the benefit of the doubt. But I would not be naive, because I'll tell you this, there's a lot of Muslims who will do all those nice things that you mentioned, and it's insincere. I actually think what you recounted was sincere. The thing about Iran, and this is why Iran figures very little in my writings, is it's got its own long, rich history, Persia. It's one of the only few places that got conquered and still maintained its religion. The fact is, your average, aside from the government, the regime, and the theocracy, your average Iranian is very secular. You know, they wear their Islam very thinly. And that's why you experienced what you experienced. And that's the case in a lot of Muslim countries. You're going to come across these people. I may have mentioned this to you before, but my best analogy to make sense of all this is, the Oscar Schindler analogy of Nazism. So we denounce Nazism as an ideology. We know it's supremacist. We know it's violent. We know it's intolerant. But we also know that there were, thousands of Germans who were nominal Nazis, and they did things like Oscar Schindler. They actually put their neck on the line to help Jews and other quote-unquote undesirables to escape. These were good people. But we don't come and say that, they were moderate Nazis, therefore Nazism's okay. Don't attack all Nazism. No. We say, yeah, they were nominal Nazis, but they actually weren't living according to its precepts. And that's exactly what you're referring to. There's millions of Muslims who are nominal, who are cultural, who are otherwise good people, who don't believe in the stuff we've been talking about. But that doesn't, in my mind, exonerate Islam, just like Oscar Schindler does not exonerate Nazism. And I think people really need to understand this distinction.
I want to get to your book. I was captivated by your book. I've had you on the Bible Answer Man broadcast, your book, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. And there are so many aspects to this book that I think are brilliant, but one of them was an insight that you had in this book that I think that most people miss, and that is there was a little lull in the storm, so to speak, between the abolishment of the caliphate by Mustafa Kemal Ataturk in 1924, and where we are now. And I think that that lull of 90 or 100 years has given us a false sense of security with respect to Islam.
Absolutely. And, you'll be happy to know that the current book I'm writing, because it is a historical book, I actually will bring up this point again. And what you're referring to is that so from the 7th century up until essentially the 19th or the 1800s, or let's say the 1700s, Islam's on the ascendancy, Europe's being attacked, we have the Barbary Wars, Thomas Jefferson fighting Algerian pirates who come and say, yeah, we're plundering and killing your sailors because our prophet tells us to do so. This is in 1800 and again in 1815. We have this long, constant jihad. Then all of a sudden, the European powers essentially just dominate the Islamic world in the 1800s and so forth. Napoleon, right around 1798, enters Egypt, essentially just takes it without basically even a battle. Or there is a battle, the Battle of Hermes. Basically, Muslims at this point learn it's over. Now remember what I said about Islam. A lot of people embrace it and convert to it because of its social boons. Now, when Muslims saw that they were actually dominated by Christians and Europeans, essentially they lost faith in their religion. And a lot of them became very, very nominal, very, very watered down. And this is the golden age for Christians like Copts and so forth, because not only were they now treated equally because Muslims and all these nations were westward looking, they were trying to westernize. So they put a religion aside, the men took off their galabeya, they shaved their beards, they put on a suit and tie, the women took off the hijab, were walking around high heels and dresses. It was a time of westernizing because that's the way you win. That's the right way, as Muslims saw. The Islamic way was the old-fashioned way. And up until 1950, there's videos of Nasser in Egypt, Kemal Abdel Nasser laughing, and all these Egyptians laughing with him at the very thought that Egyptian women will again wear the hijab or burqa, because it's so stupid and backwards. And of course, now they're all doing it. So you had this culture which was westward looking, and Islam was basically a footnote. And so many Muslims look at Turkey. The Ottoman Empire was the scourge of Christendom. And in the name of Islam and in the name of the Prophet and Allah, it was all a jihad. And it was done this way on and on and on. And then what did the Turks do? The standard bearers of jihad, they're the first one who essentially abolish almost Islam. They get rid of the Arabic script, which is what they were writing their language in for centuries. They adopt the Roman Latin alphabet. And you have Ataturk, very westward looking and so forth. So Islam was kind of the old way. And this goes on for 100 years, essentially. And this is the problem is a lot of historians start from there. That is where history of Islam and the Western world begins. And then all of a sudden, when you see ISIS and Islamic radicalism, all of that appears as an aberration, because our starting point is a sort of moderate, watered down, very westward leaning Islam. The problem, of course, is this view limits it just to the last century or so, and it completely ignores the early 1300 years, where Islam actually was like ISIS. And so, the point is, ISIS and these groups are not aberrations. In fact, it was that golden age, that watered down, westward looking Islam, that was the aberration. But unfortunately, we treat it as the starting point. And therefore, when we see ISIS, we say, oh, something went wrong.
You have pointed out and graphically portrayed what is squarely in the blind spot of the West, and that is the mass genocide that is taking place vis-a-vis Christians. Think about the Coptic Christians that were killed on the way to the monastery. That wasn't all that long ago. So many examples of Christians being crucified or being executed in some brutal way, as in beheading, or the fingertips of a father being cut off as he's watching his son being killed. I was speaking in the West Bank last year, and while I was there, heard all these stories about what is going on in terms of the elimination of Christianity in places like Gaza. I don't remember what the exact number is, but someone was saying that the number, again, I don't remember the number, but it was under 1,000 Christians left in Gaza. You're bringing to light one of the most horrendous crimes against humanity. And it seems to me that we as Western Christians oftentimes have no idea or even care or concern about what is happening to Coptic Christians. And you mentioned a whole variety of Christians in the Middle East, what's happening to them in terms of mass genocide. And this has to be brought to the fore.
Right. And you know, let's go back to the Crusades. These were Catholic Latins, the Crusaders, the Franks. And the people they went to help, they knew were Orthodox. The Copts are Orthodox as well. So they were going to help primarily the Byzantine Orthodox Empire. But, you know, to these, and they did what you're saying today's Christians are oblivious to. They actually took it. You have to understand, and it's so sad to see how it's been so misrepresented, that these Crusaders actually were very altruistic. And in what they were doing, they knew they were going to lose their lives and not gain anything. You know, the jihad was about always attacking your neighbor right next to you logistically. It doesn't take a lot. And once you consolidate there, then you take the next neighbor. They went, marched through, I don't know, 1,500 miles of harsh territory, of enemy territory, just to get to one point, Jerusalem, and to liberate it. And they went through so much trials, and people died of starvation, died from the weather, things that Muslims never did in jihad because it was much more efficient and always limited to your neighbor. So, you know, that's its own thing. So we compare and contrast that with today's Christians, who you are correct. And this happens especially with a lot, I'm sorry to say, Protestant Christians. You know, to them, Catholics are not even Christians. Orthodox, who are they? They don't even know what that is. Eventually, they're just some funny, weird. Well, in fact, that's the oldest, denomination of Christianity. Oldest Christians come from the letters of Paul. They were sent to, you know, Asia Minor, Greece. The first churches are all in the Middle East. You know, the four of the five sees, one's in Rome. All the other four are Eastern, Constantinople, Alexandria in Egypt, Antioch, and Jerusalem. You know, this is actually the cradle of Christianity. People don't know that the Copts actually, according to Henry Lane Poole, a 19th century historian archaeologist, actually are the ones who brought Christianity as far as to Ireland. And you know, he's written a lot about that, which I think is interesting, and I footnote it in my book. And so, you know, there was a vibrant communication and understanding between Christian groups.
We'll pick up Hank's conversation with Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim in just a few moments. The Bible Answer Man broadcast and CRI's growing array of outreaches have never been more needed than they are today. And that's why we won't be shy in asking you to stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian Research Institute through your persistent prayers and generous financial support. Stand with Hank Hanegraaff and CRI in this battle for life and truth and receive your copy of Muslim, what you need to know about the world's fastest growing religion as our thanks for your gift. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. We'll be back after the break with more of the Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Raymond Ibrahim on this special edition of the Bible Answer Man. Breaking the code of the book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order The Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. The Coen brothers are among the most critically acclaimed film directors of our time. Yet the meaning behind their movies is often veiled in mystery. This offers a clue about the Coens' worldview. The difficulty is part of the design. Other topics include changing attitudes toward the resurrection of Jesus. Is a pro-life hermeneutic possible? How to revive a dead church? The Jewish Talmud and its use for Christian apologetics, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org. Take the Bible Answer Man broadcast wherever you go on your phone or handheld device with the Equip app, free from the Christian Research Institute. The Equip app is available for both Apple and Android devices, so you can listen to the Bible Answer Man broadcast live each day or listen to archived programs at your convenience. You can also subscribe to the Christian Research Journal, make a donation to CRI, and read well-researched, trustworthy articles that will help you defend the faith and grow in your walk with Christ. With the Equip app from the Christian Research Institute, you'll have the answers you need to questions about Christianity, cults, and issues of theological and apologetic concern right at your fingertips wherever you go. So go to equip.org/app and download the Equip app for your phone or tablet today. Again, that's equip.org/app. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're bringing to you an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Let's rejoin the conversation as Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim conveys the dire situation in the Middle East.
But I wanted to touch on something else you actually said earlier about how bad the situation is, that it's a genocide. And I think people don't understand because, again, the media, what the media does is it only reports spectacular attacks, like what you mentioned, the monastery, the bus, I don't know, 20-some cops were killed. Or a bomb the church, which, I think three churches were bombed just in the last 3 and 4 months in Egypt. So spectacular attacks get mentioned. Now, what happens is if you're just following the news, you're not going to, it's okay. You know, they get killed, but only from terrorists. And it's, once in a while. It's not an ongoing thing. The fact is the spectacular terrorist attacks, the bombing of churches, those are the tip of the iceberg. Beneath that is an ongoing bleeding of Christians in the Islamic world, done not by terrorists, but rather by Muslim governments, Muslim individuals, Muslim mobs, Muslim whatever, okay? Open Doors, it's a human rights organization, publishes every year a report showing the 50 worst nations to be a Christian in. Habitually, 40 of the 50 are Muslim nations. And the top 10, absolute worst one, where there is, you can argue, a genocide going on against, or an ethnic cleansing, at least, against Christians, the top 10, 9, are Muslim. And yet, in all these 50 nations, the people persecuting the Christians are not ISIS, and they're not terrorists. They are just generic, run-of-the-mill Muslims. But the sort of persecution they do is not spectacular. So it's just constant discrimination, it's kidnapping of Christian women and children, it's plundering and killing them, and so forth. And that doesn't make it to the news because it's always portrayed as, oh, no, that has nothing to do with religion. That's a political thing. No, that's because of economics. Or, no, they're just poor. That's just a criminal act. All of these get thrown out. Yet when you dig deep, as I did for that book, In Crucified Again, you find that even all these little ones are the driving impetus is Islam or in jihad and the hate for infidels and so forth. And so I think that's one of the reasons people in the West don't really understand how deep-seated and prevalent this sort of attack on Christians is, because they're just limited to the very spectacular, you know, one church got bombed every few months, and they don't realize this is an ongoing bleeding at the hands of all these different Muslim manifestations, from individuals to regimes to governments. Look at Saudi Arabia, our friend. I mean, that is, the government of Saudi Arabia is immensely hostile to anything Christian. You will get arrested for celebrating Christmas quietly in your house and whipped. That's not ISIS. That's not quote-unquote terrorists. Same thing in Egypt and Pakistan, when we were talking about girls being raped and killed because there's a culture of impunity because they're infidels and who's going to help them against fellow Muslims. People doing this, they're just, yeah, they may be criminals, but they're justifying it because of Islamic teachings and doctrines. So it's a very deep-seated issue, and you're right, people don't get it. I actually think a lot of them just don't care in general. I think a lot of them don't have Christian charity, you know, so-called Christians. Because a lot of Western Christianity is something of an oxymoron to me and very much watered down. It's not the ancient Christianity preached by Christ and the apostles, which was a very robust, in which people like the Crusaders believed it. They were closer in time and space to the teachings of Christ than we are. And I think today that's why a lot of Christians simply don't care, because they're just watered down.
You know, it's also really interesting to me, I'm reading our local newspaper, and there's typically, at least on a fairly regular basis, a CARE spokesman who is well-spoken, is writing as a Muslim woman about maybe the season that you're going through. Maybe it's Ramadan, or explaining to Western people, you know, the wonders of what they do. The spin on it is absolutely, it makes you dizzy. I mean, you're thinking, wow, this is really wonderful. I mean, if you have no context, no knowledge, you're reading this as a Christian maybe, and you're thinking, this is really wonderful. I wonder what this wonderful group is. Maybe I should support them because they're so different from ISIS or whatever. But I think that the irony for this, in my mind, is that so often the spokesperson is a woman, and yet the tyranny of Islam is directed at women. And sometimes I think if you want to get this message that you and I are communicating across, you have to first start and say, look at what Islam has done to women, because that's being obscured in the West as well.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, a lot of people point out that, again, this goes back to the idea that, to me, a lot of so-called liberals, progressives, and so forth, their ultimate impetus is to denigrate Christianity. It's not any of these supposed humanitarian values that they hold. And so Western feminists will go out of their way to denounce, you know, the patriarchal culture and throwback of Western Christian civilization that still remains in the West, which is nothing compared to the fact that in Islamic countries, women are essentially chattel and virtually compared to men don't have any rights and are absolutely second, third class citizens. This is documented in its doctrines. Muhammad is on record saying women lack in religion and brains, intelligence. Muhammad says that the majority of hell is going to consist of women. One can go on and on. You know, a man can have four wives and as many women as his right hands possess, says the Quran, which means as many concubine infidels he can conquer. And yet these Western feminists, they have nothing to say about Islam because, once again, Islam is an ally in their ultimate effort to undermine Christian civilization. And so they're not going to attack it, and they're going to dissemble it, and they're going to try to corpse. I mean, there's actually academic writing that present Muhammad as some sort of prototypical feminist, because supposedly the Arabs, before he came around, used to bury alive their newborn infant daughters because they didn't want daughters. Sometimes they would do that. And he banned that. And so now he's some kind of feminist. Well, that's good. I'm glad he did that. But he also inaugurated a lot of troubling things vis-a-vis women. And, you know, that gets sidelined, ignored, whitewashed, and suppressed. And yet we find out one little thing, and whole books are written about how progressive Muhammad is. And that's why women support him, and they have nothing bad to say about Islam and so forth and so forth. But like I said, I really believe all these progressive types, their ultimate, perhaps subconscious agenda is always to just attack the main enemy. And if Islam can be an ally in this war, then it doesn't matter if fellow women are being killed or suppressed or whatever. It can be used and set up against, you know, Christian civilization.
This might be opening a big can of worms, but my son David has been asking me this question for a long time. It's the moniker secular Muslim. Is that an oxymoron? How would you parse that?
I would definitely call that an oxymoron. Secular, as I understand it, means sort of separate from religion. And Muslim is all about religion. So a Muslim, as we already explained, is one who submits to the teachings of Islam, which are believed to be religious. They're from a higher authority, supposedly Allah. You're supposed to fast, you're supposed to pray, you're supposed to go to Mecca, you're supposed to do jihad, you're supposed to support Muslims against infidels and so forth. These are believed to be religious mandates that Muslims, religious people, follow. So to tell me a secular Muslim, you know, all I can get out of that is what I was saying earlier, which is basically these cultural Muslims. You know, his name is Muhammad, and, you know, he's from the Middle East, okay? But that doesn't mean he's reading the Quran and following it. Maybe he drinks, maybe he does all these things that go against Islamic teachings. So if you want to call him secular in that sense, yes. But strictly speaking, certainly it's an oxymoron.
And I think you have sort of alluded to this already, but I think it's a misnomer to call Islam a religion, at least in the Western sanitized sense of the word. Islam is a socio-political economic system that runs on the rails of Sharia. And I suppose you have a sense of this better than most. I mean, it seems to me that when Bush went into Iraq and thought, well, we're going to establish now a democracy in Iraq, that that was ill-fated from the very beginning because Sharia stayed and stayed in Sharia.
Exactly. And once you start believing Islam is essentially the same thing as Judaism and Christianity, it shares the same morals and ethics, and therefore, if democracy works so good in the West, obviously it'll work so good in the Islamic world. You know, once you adopt that kind of thinking, you're doomed to failure from the start, because it's all built on a false premise of the Islamic Sharia aspect. But I'm sorry, you started off saying something which I really wanted to comment what was it? My brain just flipped right now. I just picked up on the last part about Bush, but your larger
point. So what I was talking about, and by the way, I have the senior moments all the time. You don't have an excuse. You're a lot younger than I am. But anyway, look, this is kind of an interesting phenomenon. I mean, people don't understand that Islam is not a religion
in the same sense that
we think of Christianity and Judaism or Buddhism being religions. I mean, it's an economic, social, political system.
Right, yeah. And what I wanted to actually say when you said that right away is, what's interesting about that is historically, now this is funny, I'll show you how, you know, the academics twist things around. Historically, Christians, medieval Christians from the time of the Crusades, in their writings, basically depict Muslims as heathens or pagans because they reject Christ. But they also say they basically, and I'm paraphrasing it, they have a system, they have a law, which allows them to conquer, which allows them to oppress, which allows them to do this. So to the medieval Christian, they did not have a religion. These are just pagans, but they do have a cult-like system. Okay, now today's academics, what they do is they take that and say, you see, these Christians were so ignorant about Islam, they couldn't even see that it was a religion. They didn't understand that it was a religion, and therefore we have to discount everything they say, because in these same Christian writings, you get all the same things that we talk about, which is it teaches violence, it teaches death for God, it teaches, you know, a carnal paradise when you die, it teaches jihad, And so they use that against these Christians to say, see, they didn't even know that Islam's a religion. They actually thought it was just some cult. Obviously, we can't listen to these foolish Christians. Well, it turns out that what we're being taught is the foolish thing. And that's the impediment to our understanding of Islam. And that's why we have the George Bushes, because they believe that narrative and they go to Iraq and try and say, okay, here we go. Here's democracy. It'll work in your system as well, won't it? To me, it's ironic. The earlier Christians and medieval Europeans had, albeit incomplete, but a better sense of what Islam was all about than we do today.
You know, I probably have to wrap this up. You think about maybe what I started talking about at the beginning of the podcast, quoting Malcolm Muggeridge. Think about the illiberal liberalism as a threat to Western civilization. Then you also have advancing Islam in many different ways. Number one being sanitized in the West, so that when you write a book like you have written or a book like I have written, I mean, you have publishers that are sifting through that book and trying to figure out some way of making absolutely sure that they're not going to be liable in some sense for what you're saying, because the narrative is still the narrative, and the narrative has to be soft on Islam. Otherwise, it sounds as though you're an alarmist or you're a sophist, or maybe even you've engaged in sloppy journalism. So, you know, it's kind of an interesting situation. Islam being sanitized in the West, Islam creating mass genocide with respect to Christians in the East, liberal liberalism. You look at this whole mixture, this whole stew. Is there, in your sense, in your world, in your mind, any hope for Western civilization other than Christians once again becoming salt and light?
I'm inclined to go with what you said, the latter. Western civilization devoid of its Christian roots is, I believe, self-destructive and suicidal. So I think void and short of a return to its spiritual roots, Western civilization is essentially done.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. To listen to this Hank Unplugged podcast interview with Islam research specialist Raymond Ibrahim in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. If you'd like to stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth, and receives our thanks for your gift, Hank Hanegraaff's book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion, or any of the other resources mentioned on the broadcast today, call our resource consultants now at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to us at CRI P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order the Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. The Coen brothers are among the most critically acclaimed film directors of our time, yet the meaning behind their movies is often veiled in mystery. This offers a clue about the Coens' worldview. The difficulty is part of the design. Other topics include changing attitudes toward the resurrection of Jesus. Is a pro-life hermeneutic possible? How to revive a dead church? The Jewish Talmud and its use for Christian apologetics, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or subscribe online at equip.org.